What's today, December 2nd?
Yeah.
All right. It's December 2nd, and we are in Judges. And we are in Judges chapter 7, I believe. It's been a while. All you got to do is give me one Sunday off, and I'm totally lost. Judges 7, we're still in the midst of the Gideon story. I got to tell you, this story is getting more and more interesting. The most fascinating parts of it are still ahead of us. Surprising parts of it to me. But we did not meet last week because of the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. We have 3 weeks today and two more. And then we'll have another break for the Christmas New Year's weekends. There'll be two weekends that we don't meet at the end of December. And then we'll be back in a more regular flow. I mentioned to Jane that we are approaching the midpoint of the year. With these breaks, the midpoint doesn't actually land until sometime in January. But we're not halfway through Judges yet. So my earlier, back in September, statement that we would just add Ruth on if we needed to is starting to look a little dubious. We may not have time to add Ruth on.
Oh, poor Ruth.
I know. She'll be okay. We'll figure it out. Ruth can be next year. I don't know what next year looks like. I don't know what next week looks like. So let's get in back into Judges. By way of very brief review, the nomadic Midianites, along with Amalekites and the eastern peoples, whoever they are, have started to come across the Jordan into Israel's territory pretty much whenever they feel like it and reap the harvest for themselves. Take the livestock for themselves, even what's left of the stubble of the fields, they graze their own herds on, and then they're gone again. And this has been going on for 7 years, so Israel is in some dire straits. They're essentially growing crops for somebody else. It's very hard for them to hold anything for themselves, although clearly in some instances, they have been successful. They've started living in caves. They've pulled away from the villages. We know, as the story goes on, that Gideon has access to at least two bulls, one of which is 7 years old, so that's one that's been successfully hidden for the whole time of this Midian oppression. But the angel of the Lord appears to Gideon, tells him that God wants him to lead Israel against the Midianites. Gideon has some faith and confidence issues. Those are bolstered along the way by a miraculous appearance of fire out of the rock to burn the meal offering that Gideon brings to the angel of the Lord. And later by a fleece that is damp when the rest of the ground is dry, and then the next morning is dry when the rest of the ground is damp. And so Gideon has these assurances, which we can easily look at and say, well, his faith was really weak. And Gideon certainly has his problems, and we're not done with Gideon's problems yet, but he is listed in the roster of the faithful, examples from the Old Testament in Hebrews 11. So God is certainly not put out by Gideon needing these reassurances. So he calls out for an army from the tribes of Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali and his own tribe of Manasseh. There's the whole thing with his father's altar. We don't need to review all of this detail or take too long. But the ripples begin to work out from his father to his town, to his tribe, to his clan, to his tribe. And then he calls this army together. And God says, that's too many people. I don't want you to take credit for this. I want it to clearly be me that has done this for you. So whittle this army of 32,000 people down. First they say, hey, if you're nervous about this, you really would rather not do it, you can go home. Two-thirds of them go home. 10,000 left, and they send them to the river to drink, and they split them up according to how they collect their drinking water, and they're down to 300. And God says, that's just about right. And that's roughly where we left it last time. I think we'd gotten a little farther than that, but we hadn't gotten to the battle itself. So they get these 300. They send the other 9,700 or so home.
Aaron,
yeah.
I don't know what keeps happening. It just keeps going.
Technical difficulty here. I'm muted now.
Nah, it's doing something. It's okay.
All right. I think it's on your side. But yeah, I can hear it too. Well, that's frustrating. All right. So we'll have the other Eric take a look at it. So they have their 300. And they provision themselves probably from what the 10,000 have before they head home. And that puts us around chapter 7, verse 15. In spite of Gideon asking for reassurances all along the way, God actually, without Gideon asking, gives him one more reassurance before the battle. Remember, he tells Gideon to go down at night into the Midian camp, and when he does so with his servant, he hears Midianites talking about a dream one of them had. And another one says that that dream surely is symbolic of Gideon. They know him by name for some reason, the Israelite, and that they're going to suffer at his hand, be given into his hand. Now, panic plays a role in the battle. I'm sure some of you know the story, maybe all of you know the story. It sounds like God is already sowing the seeds of this panic among the Midianites before the battle is ever even joined. Before they even know that they have a battle coming at them this night. But Gideon hears the dream, gives him another boost of confidence. He worships God in response to hearing the dream, and he goes back to the camp. And I'm in 7:15 now, and he says, "Arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand." Now listen to the battle logistics here. This is really interesting. Verse 16, he divided the 300 men into three companies, presumably 100 each, and put trumpets, shofar, ram's horns, into the hands of all of them, and empty jars with torches inside the jars. And those jars were used to conceal the flames until you wanted to pull the torch out and have it be more useful. And he said to them, "Look at me and do likewise. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then blow the trumpets also on every side of all the camp and shout for the Lord and for Gideon." So they have trumpets. They have torches. They have clay pots. Offensive combat technology at its best, right? Well, so the battle finally happens. Gideon, therefore, and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch, when they had just set the watch. Now, I'm not a military person. There are military people in this room who can speak to this much better than I can, but my understanding is that a change of watch is a somewhat vulnerable time, because if something happens right then, it can increase the confusion. The Midianites are not necessarily a trained fighting force either. They're nomads. So I'm not looking for this to be a strong military encampment. But those going off the watch, those coming on the watch, may be unsure as to who's in charge in that instant, may be confused as to, in the dark, who is the enemy and who is not. There are a lot of human reasons we can try to piece together why it happens the way it's about to happen, but we really don't have enough information, and none of it, I don't think, can explain why an army of 135,000, and we will find out in chapter 8 that that is the number we're dealing with here, an army of 135,000 armed men all turn on themselves. Verse 20. In other words, it's a God thing, no matter how much you want to try to explain it. It's a God thing. Verse 20, then the three companies blew their trumpets and broke the jars. They held in their left hands the torches and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Now notice verse 21. Every man stood in his place around the camp, and all the army, that would be the Midianites, and all the army ran. They cried out and fled. So picture this. They have surrounded the camp, probably higher ground. It's dark, middle of the night. 300 Israelites, probably spread out just in a single line around. They light their torches, they throw down their clay pots, which makes enough noise to cause concern and alarm, and they blow the ram's horns. Now you're down in the Midianite camp. What are you seeing? You're seeing torchmen suddenly surrounding the camp. The torchmen would have been leading the squads. Not everybody would carry the torch because they have shields, swords, things like that to be carrying. So to see 300 torches suggests that there's a whole lot more than 300 people. Then you hear 300 ram's horns. Not that you know it's that many, but it's loud. Not every squad has a ram's horn in the hands of every person. They only need one to signal. So they think there's a lot more than 300 trumpeters as well. It's a grand illusion. And whether the clay pots were interpreted as the rattling of swords, shields, armor, I don't know, possibly. But this whole thing is a grand illusion. God has given instructions that lead the Midianites to think there is a much stronger force surrounding them here in the middle of the night than there really is. Panic has already begun to be sown divinely through this dream, which is making its way through the camp, in the gossip around the campfires. The watch has just changed. Everything is perfect for it to have the maximum confusing effect, and it does. And the marvelous thing about all of this is that verse 21 is Israel's logistical plan. Stand there. Just stand there. Light the torches, break the pots, blow the ram's horns, and then just stand there and watch. That's the military plan. And they watch the Midianites panic, turn on each other. And the Midianites do all the fighting for Israel against themselves and each other. Verse 22, when they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword again. Oh, and by the way, let me mention one other thing. What did Gideon tell them to shout for the Lord and for Gideon? That was up in verse 18. What did they shout?
A sword
for the Lord and for Gideon. Now, I don't know if that means that they weren't doing what they were told, or if it's a detail that doesn't necessarily have to be reconciled, but it's a little bit delicious. Because we already know, the text has explicitly told us, every one of them is holding a torch in his left hand and a ram's horn in his right. A sword for the Lord and for Gideon? They don't have swords. It's been a recurring theme up to this point in Judges that Israel doesn't have swords. The Philistines and the Canaanites have cornered the market on the blacksmithing. And Israel, ordinarily in all of this, doesn't have the weaponry that the other force has. These guys don't have swords. But, you know, don't tell the Midianites that. So, verse 22 again, when they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's, Midianite man's, sword against his comrade and against all the army. So they start fighting each other, and the army fled. And we will find out later in chapter 8, but I'll just say it now because it doesn't harm the story. Of the 135,000, 115,000 don't make it. Only 20,000 get out. Now, maybe more than that get out from this moment, but there's a pursuit. And at the other end of the pursuit, there's far, 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 far fewer Midianites. And the army fled, and I should bring the map up now. Remember, this whole thing starts on the border, the southwestern border of Asher and Zebulun and Issachar, where it meets Manasseh, West Manasseh. That's all where this is happening, especially over toward the Issachar side. And then this is the better map, because that actually shows the path of the various forces in this battle. So the battle is joined up where you see the purple arrows and the red circle up in the north of this map. And the black line shows the flight of the Midianites. And they flee as far as Beth Shittah toward Zerarah, as far as the border of Abel Mehalah by Tabat. Well, why didn't you just say so? Not familiar names, but you can see most of these names on the map. They break for the Jordan Valley. They're going to retreat back to their own territory. And so they come down the Jordan Valley to Abel Mehalah, and they keep going south, and they're going to break across at the Jabbok River, and we'll get to that. But that's what's happening. They fled east into the Jordan Valley, and now they're heading south where they can make good time in their retreat. Verse 23, and the men of Israel were called out from, these are the same tribes that were mentioned before, with exception of Zebulun, from Naphtali and from Asher and from all Manasseh, and they pursued after Midian. In a way, it's not much of a battle. You get all that build up, and then all you do are light some torches and blow some trumpets and watch the enemy destroy themselves on your behalf. In today's cinematic frame of mind, we want some grand battle scene. And maybe there was one, but it was only the Midianites. And Scripture doesn't take many verses to lay it out for us. And so we had all that preparation. The battle takes very little space on the page. But now we're going to get into the aftermath. And that takes some time. But before I get to the aftermath, I want to share something else with you that I came across quite by serendipity as we were getting ready for yesterday's Advent by Candlelight event that we held here. And this isn't something I said yesterday. If you were at Advent by Candlelight, this is not something I said yesterday. But there is a very familiar prophecy about the coming Messiah in the book of Isaiah in chapter 9. And I would invite you to turn there. Isaiah 9. The verses we're familiar with are a little scattered through this chapter. Verse 2, which we did read yesterday, is extremely familiar. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. And if you skip down then to verse 6, For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, etc., etc. Okay? Utterly classical, familiar messianic prophecies in Isaiah that we hear this time of year, every year, and rightfully so. But I want you to notice something that we skipped over. Let's pick up the whole thing. Let's start it at verse 1. But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them a light has shone. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. Isaiah's prophecy about Messiah says that he is going to free his people as dramatically as God helped his people in the day of Midian. That is Judges 7. That is the story of Gideon that we're looking at right now. It's the moment that we just finished looking at. Gideon was given what to all human expectations was a suicide mission. Go and take out the Midianites, who when they pour into the land are innumerable. But I'm nobody. Yeah, but I'm with you. So put out the call. You got 32,000. Yeah, you're still outnumbered 4-1, but you know what? We don't want 32,000. Let's whittle it down to 300. This is a suicide mission. What appears to be a tiny force against an overwhelming force. Not unlike Israel, weakened inside the Roman Empire. not unlike Israel in captivity in Babylon. But God is going to work for them. And just as Gideon and his 300 men would not, and human expectations have any chance whatsoever, so we see Jesus born, one man, no power, no standing, and yet God saves his people through him and expands the tents of his people to include all the nations. And Isaiah is making that connection here in Isaiah 9 with these verses that we're so familiar with, but buried in the middle of them is this statement. You have broken the rod of the oppressor as you did on the day of Midian. I just thought it was pretty cool that that comes into play. And that connection is made between what God does for Israel through Gideon and the promise of Messiah in Isaiah. Having said that, let me warn you about something. Gideon has been quite the hero. Lacking confidence, lacking faith, reassured by God, maybe more times than he deserved. And he's followed the plan, and he's led the people, and he's routed, or God has routed, the enemy. But I said there's a lot of aftermath to this battle. The story of Gideon has a long ways to go. And it's going to start including some things that might cause you to furrow your brow and think, why would he do that? Or arch an eyebrow and question, is that actually what God would want him to do? And I'm just going to give it away right now. Early on, it's a little hard to tell. But as episode after episode after episode follows in the aftermath of this battle, Gideon ceases to be anything remotely resembling a hero. We are now going to be looking at the fall and decline of Gideon the hero. And it's tragic. But it's what had happened. It's what happened. So let's step into it. Frankly, the first thing that might be questionable is exactly what we just read. The men of Israel were called out from Naphtali and from Asher and from all Manasseh, and they pursued after Midian. Why was that necessary? Doesn't that go against the flow of the plan that God just laid out? Gideon, you only need 300 men. Now suddenly you need to call in all the surrounding tribes? It might make sense. They want to cut the Midianites off. They want to stop them from crossing the Jordan. We saw a similar tactic with Eglon and his forces. They were cut off from the nearest crossing of the Jordan. And that may be what they're after here, and they need the other tribes to do it, or they think they need the other tribes to do it. Hard to say. But I think it's an easy thing to just read through and not give a second thought about. But it plays into the things that continue to happen here. It seems to go in the opposite direction of the way that God has done this. Because now when they chase the Midianites down and they capture them, who's going to get the glory for that? Israel is more likely to be able to claim glory for itself instead of give that glory to Yahweh. We'll see if it happens. Verse 24. Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim. Ephraim has not been in the story up until now. When Gideon called for his army, he called for them from all the tribes that were north of Ephraim. But now Ephraim, down south of Manasseh, the hill country, is near the Jordan Valley. And Gideon has sent messages hoping to intercept the Midianites. I'm always afraid when I say Gideon and Midian, I'm going to switch them because they sound so similar. Forgive me if I do. I think I've done it right. Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and capture the waters against them, as far as Beth Barah," which you can see in the little red circle on the map, "and also the Jordan." So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they did what they were asked. They captured the waters as far as Beth Barah and also the Jordan, and they captured the two princes, some translations will say generals, of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeeb they killed at the winepress of Zeeb. Clearly, two places that came to be named for the foreign leaders that were captured and killed there. Then they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeeb to Gideon across the Jordan. Across the Jordan. So if Gideon's hope was to stop the Midianites from getting back across the Jordan, it failed. Because Gideon, in his pursuit, has already crossed the Jordan after them when Ephraim brings him the bodies of these two Midianite princes or kings. Not the bodies, the heads. A bit more gruesome, easier to transport. So they come across the Jordan and they deliver those heads to Gideon, who's already across the Jordan himself. The plan to stop Midian from crossing the Jordan didn't work. And now there's a little moment of confrontation. And this again is something that's a little head-scratching. Not only has Gideon called in for reinforcements from Asher, Naphtali, then he added Ephraim to the mix to try to cut off the enemy to the south. Chapter 8, verse 1, "Then the men of Ephraim said to him, 'What is this that you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian?' And they accused him fiercely." Ephraim is upset that they didn't get to be part of the fun. Ephraim is upset that they didn't get to be part of Israel's army against the Midianites. Ephraim probably does not realize how that battle played out. And it would be appropriate for Gideon to tell them, "Guys, I appreciate your enthusiasm, but God told us to do this a particular way, and I was just doing it the way God instructed. And even if you had been part of the original call, which God did not tell me to include you, so if that's a problem, take it up with him carefully. But we whittled it down to 300 men. You all couldn't have been part of it no matter what." Gideon doesn't say any of that. One other point. Not knowing how the battle actually played out, what is Ephraim really upset about here? That they don't get credit. That they didn't get to be part of the army so they don't get the glory.
Their sediment would not have been the same had it been a loss.
Their sentiment would not have been the same had it been a loss. No argument there. Ephraim is involved in some glory seeking here. And this is foreshadowing something that we will see later in other stories in Judges. This isn't the last time Ephraim is going to do this. Ephraim is going to come back in other stories, the story of Jephthah most immediately, and do the same thing. They're going to be upset that they weren't in a position to get the glory for what happens. And later, it's actually going to lead to Israelite-on-Israelite warfare. So Ephraim's glory-seeking is going to be a growing problem. Nevertheless, what does Gideon say? They're upset. End of verse 1, they accused him fiercely. Verse 2, and he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you?" I'm sorry, maybe I'm being too picky about the words, but what have I done? What have I done? No, what has Yahweh done? Anyway, what have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you? Then the anger against him subsided when he said this. So maybe it's a diplomatic answer. He gives them essentially the glory that they're hungry for. He at least gives God credit for giving the Midianite princes into their hands. But I have to tell you, if you start paying attention now to the rest of the Gideon story, there is almost no mention of God. This is one. There'll be another one or two. But God is disappearing from this story. Fellas, the leftovers in your vineyards are better than what I could do. I don't hold a candle to you guys. You don't need to be upset at me. I'm nothing compared to you. Very ingratiating. Would have been nice if he hadn't, if he'd been more explicit about what God had done rather than what he had done. But again, it's hard to say, except that I've already given it away, whether that's really drifting away from what he should be doing. It's going to become clearer and clearer. Verse 4, Gideon came to the Jordan. Actually, we're a little out of sync now because we already know he was across the Jordan when they brought him the heads of those princes. Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over, he and the 300 men who were with him, exhausted. Well, yes, yet pursuing. So he said to the men of Succoth, which is on the map, eastern side of the Jordan Valley. He's in the Transjordan area now. He's still in Israel. The east side of the Jordan was given to Manasseh and Reuben. So he's among his countrymen. So he said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zebah and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." Interesting that he knows the names of his enemy. That hadn't come out before. And the officials of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your army?" In other words, they're saying, if you haven't conquered them already, we're not going to help you. And frankly, that may be a very understandable attitude. Because look at it from their point of view. What do they know about these kings of the Midianites? They've been dealing with them too. They hit this area before they get across the Jordan. They know how many of them there are. They see them come in and pass through. They may not know how many losses they've suffered. We do, or we will soon later in this chapter, 135,000 down to about 15 or 20,000. And what's Gideon have to pursuing them? 300 men. Are you serious? You're chasing after the Midianite kings with 300 men. And if we help you, and they defeat you, as they invariably, inevitably will, then where does that put us? They're going to come back, and they're going to get even with us for helping you. So no, we're not going to give you bread. We're not going to provision your puny little 300-man squad.
I'm curious as to why Gideon didn't call them out like he did Manasseh and the other tribes.
Yeah?
It doesn't seem to make sense, in a way.
No argument. So let's see. That puts us at verse 7. So Gideon said, "Well then, when the Lord has given Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." Wow. What happened to Gideon who said, "I can't do this"? What happened to Gideon who fell on his knees in the dark of the camp of Midianites and said, "Thank you, Lord, for this dream and the confidence to do what you're asking me to do"? Suddenly, Gideon is vengeful. If you won't help me, then after I win this, I'm going to come back and punish you. Definitely changing. Verse 8. From there he went up to Penuel. Up because he's moving away from the valley, so the land gets higher. And spoke to them in the same way, and the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered. "No, we are not going to help. That's only going to get us into trouble with the Midianites." And Gideon said to the men of Penuel in verse 9, "When I come again in peace," some of your translations may say "in victory." Peace is the better translation, and it matters, and I'll tell you why in a minute. "When I come again in peace, I will break down this tower." He's threatening his fellow Israelites. He's threatening his fellow Israelites. Now, I said that the fact that it's in peace matters, because you can see instances, and the best one, well, I'm not going to go forward and look at it in detail, but the best one is in the history of King David. There's a point in the story where David is fighting against the descendants of Saul, Ishbosheth and others, and I'm going to get the names wrong here. Maybe I should have had his turn there. Abner and Abiezer are after each other. And I've got it flipped in my head now which one is fighting for David and which one isn't. I believe it's Abner that has caused all the trouble. But Abner comes to David in peace to negotiate an end to the hostilities. And he leaves David in peace. And Abiezer finds out about it and avenges the death of his brother. His brother had died in battle. That's not considered murder under the Torah. But he avenges his brother's death and he kills Abner in peace. It's murder. Take that and swing it back over here to the story about Gideon. He tells the men of Penuel, "When I come again in peace, I'm going to tear down the tower." Something has gotten into Gideon. Verse 10. Now, these Midianite kings, Zebah, Zalmunna, were in Karkor with their army. And you can see that they probably went up the Jabbok River for speed and then cut down the pass to Karkor. With their army, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the army of the people of the east, for there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword. And Gideon went up by the way of the tent dwellers east of Nobah and Yogbahah and attacked the army, for the army felt secure. In other words, Gideon outflanked them. They're fleeing from the west and from the north at this point, and they're looking over their shoulders. But Gideon gets around and comes at them from the east, which is not what they would have expected. And Zebah and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zebah and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heresh, which is very likely the more traditional route than his cross-country shortcut. Probably not a shortcut. They probably worked really hard to get ahead of the armies there. And he captured a young man of Succoth and questioned him. And the young man wrote down for him the officials and elders of Succoth, 77 men. And Gideon came to the men of Succoth and said, "Behold, Zebah and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted?' And he took the elders of the city, and he did exactly what he had threatened to do. And he took thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson." Some translations say he threshed them with these thorns and briars. Not cool. And, verse 17, he broke down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. It's not clear whether the men of the city were killed in the fall of the tower or if those were two separate acts. It really doesn't matter. Gideon has come back victorious and has attacked his fellow Israelites. We are now somewhere beyond hero. And now, whoever wrote this story, I think it was Samuel, begins to shed some light on all of this from this end of the story. And if we think about the implications of what we're going to learn here, it begins to change the way we see the whole story. This is like a twist and a reveal two-thirds of the way through a movie plot. Verse 18. Then Gideon said to Zebah and Zalmunna, "Where are the men whom you killed at Tabor?" Wait a minute, what? Where are the men you killed at Tabor? Where did that come from? This story was never at Tabor. Tabor is the north fork of the Jezreel Valley. That's not where this all unfolded. So clearly there's some history here that Gideon knows about, but it's the first we've heard of it. "Where are the men whom you killed at Tabor?" They answered, "As you are, so were they. Every one of them resembled the son of a king." And Gideon said, "They were my brothers." And he does not mean that metaphorically. They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you. So he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise and kill them. But the young man did not draw his sword. Well, they've got swords now. For he was afraid because he was still a young man. Then Zebah and Zalmunna said, rise yourself and fall upon us. For as the man is, so is his strength. And Gideon arose and killed Zebah and Zalmunna. And he took the crescent ornaments that were on the necks of their camels. Zebah and Zalmunna, at some point in the past, killed Gideon's brothers. That puts a whole different light on what we were told when we first met Gideon, and he said to the angel of the Lord, I'm nobody. I am the youngest in my family. But apparently, he was the only surviving member of his family, at least of his brothers. His father Joash was still alive, of course. And I don't know what to make, to be honest with you, about this statement that, like you, they all resembled princes. They all resembled the son of a king. Something about the sons of Joash, something about Gideon, that had some royal bearing, some noble appearance. We don't know exactly what it is, but Gideon had it too. Unless they're just trying to ingratiate themselves, but admitting that they killed his brothers is not really going to help if that's the case. There's something going on here. Most importantly, Gideon has gone from being somebody who didn't think he could help or be used of God to someone who has turned this mission into a campaign of revenge. He's taken the victory that God gave Israel through him, and he's turned it to become a campaign of vengeance against those who killed his brothers. He's completely twisted it, completely derailed it, and is now pursuing things that God never told him to do for reasons that are just born out of the hatred of his own heart. Gideon is not a hero anymore. Not now. And that business about having the appearance of a son of a king is going to come into play at least twice more in this story. One of them right now, and this will be the last thing we can do. Verse 22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also. They want to make the house of Gideon, that doesn't even exist yet necessarily, king. They want to make it the royal house of Israel. Rule over us, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian. Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. Okay, good. That's a good thing to say. That's nice to hear. Except, we're going to find out, it's just words. And Gideon said to them, let me make a request of you. every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil. For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So these peoples of the east would have had golden earrings, and it would have been part of the plunder that Israel had from the battle. And they answered, we will willingly give them. And they spread a cloak, and every man threw in it the earrings of his spoil. And the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold. Anybody have a footnote that that converts that? 43 pounds? 43 pounds of gold. Nice. Besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, and besides the collars that were around the necks of their camels. So 43 pounds of gold plus. And Gideon made, just when you think he said the right thing, and Gideon made an ephod. And Gideon made an ephod of it and put it in his city, in Ophrah. An ephod is a priestly garment. The high priest wore an ephod. Aaron had an ephod. It was made of gold. It was for the high priest. Gideon has made an ephod. He has no business doing that. And he puts it in his city in Ophrah. And all Israel whored after it there. And it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. The man who tore down the altar to Baal and cut down the Asherah pole has now installed essentially a pagan ephod, a new object of false worship in the same town. Tragic. He seems to be more filled with himself than with the Spirit of God somewhere along the way. But, and this is where we'll stop, so Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more, and the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon. But we're not done talking about Gideon. There are more issues here and more tragic consequences of his story that we'll get into next time. Wow, what a turn, huh? Any thoughts? Questions? Elmer?
Yeah, I had two thoughts. One was about battle, kind of went the way like Jericho did.
It did very much go like Jericho, didn't it?
Yes, shattering the thing at the last minute.
Yeah.
The whole thing falling all apart and all that.
Yeah, you didn't have walls falling down, but you had the army falling in against itself.
All the battles where God did intervene was very, very miraculous. It was usually just a few people. It wasn't an overwhelming force. Second comment was that when Christ was around, they asked him to look for a sign, give us a sign. And Christ was saying, well, you've seen all these signs around you. Why can't you understand it? I'll give the exact quote on it. But in the earlier part of the Old Testament, everything was, a sign was to indicate it was God's will. Whereas they didn't need this in the new, in Christ, because he was performing all these miracles and coming up with answering all kinds of prophecies and everything.
So how are you tying that to the Gideon story here?
He had the fleece he laid down there.
Yep.
And do this. And I'm not exactly sure yet. Do it the opposite way. See if that will still work.
Yep.
So he was looking for the sign.
He was looking for the sign. Definitely.
People Christ did. They were looking for a sign to know if he was really the true one. If he was the one.
Yep. Well, isn't it Paul who says Israel looks for, the Jews look for a sign?
Pardon me?
I think it's Paul who writes in the Romans, the Jews look for a sign.
Yeah.
Yep. It's part of their history. There's no doubt in my mind, this is the last thing I'll say, we'll pray, because there's people waiting at the door. I've said before that there are indications that the book of Judges is not written in a linear chronology. We do not know for sure that this story about Gideon happened after the story of Deborah and Barak. There's some evidence that it may have actually happened before. But there is no doubt in my mind now that there is a reason Samuel set them side by side in the story. Because you have very similar battles that could not possibly have been won except that God fought for his people. With a flash flood against the Canaanites, with this chaos within Midian. But the aftermath of the battles is so utterly, utterly different. Because Deborah and Barak write a song of praise that gives all the glory to Yahweh. But Gideon pursues his own agenda of vengeance and power, and there couldn't be more contrast in the aftermath of these two battles. We'll finish looking at that next week. Let's pray. Father, thank you for the lessons of your word. They are not all positive lessons. So many of them are lessons that warn us if we can see what's happening. This story of Gideon is both. It has been a lesson in faithfulness and confidence that you fight for your people. But now it is a warning that we not fall into taking credit ourselves, that we not give in to the vengeful agendas of our own hearts. Grant that we could learn the lessons we need from both and better serve you in your kingdom. In Jesus' name, amen.